I mentioned to you in another lesson that survey that I saw the results of in the newspaper a few weeks ago about this new national study that has been done about the religious beliefs of the American people. And that study reported that 98% of Americans say they believe that there is a God. And so it would appear that Americans, by and large, would at least say to some opinion poll taker that they believe there is a God. And many of them would claim that they are people who pray from time to time and maybe even attend some kind of religious services once in a while. But I hope I'm not being too pessimistic or too much of a cynic. And yet it seems to me that the average American hardly ever thinks about God in any kind of a practical sense on a day-to-day basis. They may say they believe there's a God, but when it comes down to the actual activities in which people engage on a day-to-day basis, it just looks a whole lot like the average American doesn't spend any great amount of time thinking about God. In this series of lessons, we've been talking about diligently seeking God. And I think a person does not qualify truly as a religious person unless they're doing what this verse talks about, diligently seeking God. And there just aren't a whole lot of people who are doing that. Maybe seeking Him in some sense, but at least not diligently seeking Him. And so that's what we want to think about tonight. The passage says we must not only seek Him, but seek Him diligently. And that really goes to the heart of the matter, doesn't it? God will be found by us not by some casual or convenient seeking of God, but by a seeking that can rightfully be described as a diligent seeking of God. But what does that mean? What's so important about that? Why should we give any more diligence to God than we already do? My mother used to have an expression in which she'd talk about somebody going all out for something. And what she meant by that is that that person just thought that that was the most important thing in the world and would just pursue that without any reservation at all. Well, could it not be said that that's what Hebrews 11 verse 6 is saying? That we need to go all out in regard to our seeking of Him. Let me ask you a question. What do you think is the worst insult that could be offered to God? If you wanted to offend God in the worst way possible, how would you go about that? You might think, for example, of the person who just has an outright rebellious attitude toward God and would just shake their fist in His face, so to speak, and say, "I refuse to do your will." Kind of like Pharaoh did, you know, when Moses went in and said, "Let the people of Israel go." And Pharaoh said, "Who is God that He should tell me what to do with the people in my kingdom? I'll do what I want to, thank you." That would be offensive to God, wouldn't it? That would insult His majesty and His authority. But you know, don't you, if you study the Bible, that's not the worst way in which God can be insulted. The worst insult is indifference. Apathy. Just not caring very much one way or another. When you look at the passages in the Bible where there is a very strong condemnation of something, very often it's not for some horrible form of immorality as we would consider it. The sternest rebukes in the Bible are reserved for the people who are just apathetic and don't care very much. You might think, for example, in Revelation chapter 3 of the letter to the church in Laodicea, the lukewarm church, you remember. The words that were said were, I guess, as strong a language as you find in any of those seven letters to any of those churches. "I know your work," this is Revelation 3 verse 15, "but you are neither cold nor hot. I could wish that you were cold or hot. So then because you are lukewarm and neither cold nor hot, I will spew you out of my mouth." Probably aware of the fact that the language there literally means, "I will vomit you out of my mouth." There's nothing any more nauseating to the Lord than lukewarmness. You prefer we'd be hot or cold. Either love him or hate him, but don't just not care. That's the worst thing that could be done. If you turn over to the Old Testament, the very last book in the Old Testament, the little prophecy of Malachi. The people in Malachi's day, after they had come back from their Babylonian captivity, and you'd have thought that would have taught them to care very deeply about God, but within 100 years of them coming back from their Babylonian captivity, they had already lapsed again into this apathetic way of approaching God. And so in Malachi 1, verse 10, God said, "Who is there even among you who would shut the doors so that you would not kindle fire on my altar in vain? I have no pleasure in you, says the Lord of hosts." Now, that's strong language, isn't it? When the Lord would go so far as to say, your indifferent worship of me is worse than no worship at all, you'd be ahead of what you're doing now if you just close the doors of the temple and not even go through this apathetic business. That indicates, doesn't it, how strongly the Lord is offended by apathy and indifference. But how can we avoid offering that terrible insult of indifference? I'd like to put the next points up on the screen one at a time, but you're going to see them all at once here. So it's a little bit intimidating when you see that many items. You look at your watch, you know, and think, will we ever get out of here? But I'll briefly talk about those, I promise you. What you've got on that list is a list of some words that I think are close to the idea of diligence, and they kind of come at the idea of diligence from a different direction. For example, the word sincerity. Wouldn't we agree that if we're going to seek God more diligently, we would need to be more sincere about our seeking of Him? To be sincere means that you really mean it. You're not just pretending that your seeking of God is the real thing. Well, we all need to be more sincere, don't we? We need to care as much as we say that we care. If somebody asks you, do you care about God? Most of us would say yes. But we need to care about Him as deeply as we would pretend to, so we could be more sincere. What about the word seriousness? When I say we need to be more serious about God, I don't really mean that we ought not to ever have any sense of humor. What I mean by that is, well, my youngest son Grant, for example, is a serious golfer. He takes golf very seriously. And consequently, he's a much better golfer than I am, who likes to play golf, but I don't take it very seriously. And my score shows that. That doesn't mean Grant can't ever laugh about golf or doesn't ever see the lighter side of that. That means he is diligent in his pursuit of that particular activity. He sees that it's something he really wants to devote himself to in a serious way. Well, don't we need to take God more seriously? I believe we do. And that is in the same ballpark of the idea of diligence. Decisiveness is something we also need more of. And by that I mean, when we commit ourselves to the Lord and say, I am going to seek Him diligently, then we need to do that. We need to be able to make decisions and make those decisions stick. Too often what happens is our love for the Lord kind of cools off and we become uncertain and batted back and forth a little bit between whether we care deeply or we don't care deeply, and so we're not very decisive in what we do. The word passion, I think, rightly ought to describe our seeking of the Lord. Passion's not a bad word. We, in our culture, tend to think of passion only in terms of sexual passion. Passion simply means deep feeling. And if there's anything we ought to feel deeply about, it's the subject of God. And I'm telling you, we need to inject some passion into our relationship with the Lord. There needs to be some strong feeling of heart. Yes, I know it's not just a matter of feelings and emotions. But I'm afraid sometimes in trying to help people understand that religion is not just a matter of emotion, we go to the opposite extreme and leave the emotion entirely out of it. And so our seeking of God is not as diligent as it ought to be because we're not very passionate about it. In fact, we're a good deal more passionate about some of our worldly pursuits than we are in our pursuit of God. And energy, I think, is a word that has to do with diligence. We work a lot harder at our worldly activities sometimes than we do at our relationship with the Lord. I agree with William Barclay in his commentary on one of the New Testament books when he said, if the Lord's people would show half as much energy in working on their relationship with God as worldly people spend energy on their worldly pursuits, then look at what we could accomplish. It is truly amazing, isn't it, what can be accomplished in terms of worldly goals when somebody just throws all of their energy into it every 4 years when the Olympics come around. It just amazes me to see those young athletes who have had to work as hard for a lifetime, really, to even get to compete in the Olympics, to reach that level, that world-class level of athletic competition. For years, they have had to eat, drink, and sleep that. They have had to work hard at it. And if they win the gold medal, all they got is a gold medal that says at one moment in time, you were the best in the world at this activity. Can you imagine what we could accomplish in the Lord's work if we'd work with as much energy at that as these people do trying to win an Olympic gold medal? There wouldn't be many obstacles that could stand in our way if we'd work that hard at it. But we need to work harder at it. That's diligently seeking the Lord. Energy and persistence, too, which means that you keep on seeking. You don't just seek diligently for a while and then kind of cool off about that idea. You persist. You persevere. And finally, the most obvious of all, I suppose, would be love. Do you remember what Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 13 about love? I know you've read it many times. He personifies love here and says, here's how love would behave if love were a person. And so he says that love suffers long, is kind, it does not envy, verse 4. Love does not parade itself, it's not puffed up, and all of that. But do you remember what he began that great discussion of love by saying in verses 1 and following? Though I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but have not love, I have become as a sounding brass or a clanging cymbal. And though I have the gift of prophecy and understand all mysteries and all knowledge, and though I have all faith so that I could remove mountains, but have not love, I am nothing. Now look at verse 3. Though I bestow all my goods to feed the poor, and though I give my body to be burned, but have not love, it profits me nothing. Have you ever thought about what that says? That raises the possibility that somebody, for whatever reason, might go so far as to give their body to be burned for the Lord, and it be for some reason other than love of the Lord. That's a possibility. People do things, amazing things, for all kinds of reasons, sometimes other than the right reason. But if a person would go that far, you'd say, well, surely somebody who would lay down their life for the Lord is a seeker of the Lord. Not necessarily. Paul says it'd be possible for somebody to even give their body to be burned and it not be on the basis of even loving the Lord. And he said, if not, then that's nothing. That would have profited you nothing if you went that far. Remember that list of things we put on the screen the other night that are not the same as seeking God? Church attendance, Bible study, prayer, personal evangelism, all those things. Very important things. But if those things are not done for the right reasons, if it's not love that fuels all of that, what's Paul saying? It's just a big zero. And so, what about our seeking of the Lord? How does that figure into our seeking of the Lord? You may not have thought about it very much. We're going to talk about motives some more tomorrow night. But you may not have thought about it very much. But if you will think about it, I think you'll have to agree, if you look honestly even at your own heart, that there might be a lot of different reasons why people would do the right thing, at least the thing that seems right on the outside, other than the right reason. There are all kinds of reasons why Well, somebody might be sitting in one of these pews tonight. We'd be honest about it, other than seeking the Lord. But what Paul says here in 1 Corinthians 13, that's why I highlighted it on this list, is that no matter what we do that outwardly might look like we're seeking the Lord, if that is not fueled by the love, by the motive of true love for the Lord, then not only is it not seeking God, it's not anything. It's worthless. So as you look at that list, and as I look at that list, could you be any more sincere in seeking God than you are? Could you take God any more seriously? Could you be more decisive and more passionate and more energetic and more persistent? Could you love the Lord more genuinely than you do tonight? It's embarrassing for me to look at that list. I've got a long way to go in every one of those items. We do, don't we? And so when we talk about diligently seeking God, we're sitting across the kitchen table trying to help somebody who's never obeyed the first principles of the gospel to understand what it takes to be just simply a New Testament Christian. And we try to impress upon them that they need to seek God and they need to seek God diligently. Folks, we need to look in the mirror and ask ourselves whether we're doing that or not. How sincere and serious and decisive and passionate and energetic and persistent and loving was your seeking of God today? And how much of those ingredients of diligently seeking God were in my life? Well, I want to talk with you about a couple of things that I think we're going to have to do if we will seek God diligently in terms of the Scriptures. And these really go together. I want to talk about them kind of together. We're going to have to seek God both fervently and faithfully. If you leave either of those out, you don't seek God diligently. Of course, I know both of those are equally important, but you've got to have them together. Okay? So let's talk about them separately, but I want you to understand that both of these have to be kept in mind. You can't just seek God fervently with a lot of emotional energy, and you can't seek Him just faithfully. You've got to start seek Him fervently and faithfully. First of all, what does fervent mean? Well, that means with strong feeling, with fervor, or with zeal. Jesus said in Matthew 5 and verse 6, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled." Do we hunger and thirst for the righteousness of God? Is hunger and thirst accurately describe your awareness of how much you need God? Or when you think of God, is it just kind of something that's an interesting thing to think about? Every time I read that beatitude where Jesus said, "Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness," it kind of reminds me of an incident of my good friend Lee Wildman told me about a trip he and his family took down to the Smoky Mountains one year. If you've ever been to the Smokies, you know they're bears along the side of the road, and they're so used to the tourists down there, they depend upon the tourists to feed them, and so they've forgotten how to find food on their own. And he said they were down there one year, and they stopped at this place where there are bears, you know, that the tourists can look at, and you can throw food at them. And he said there was one big old bear out there that probably been out there, you know, for 100 years or more, just a big old fat bear that had been living off the tourists, and he was sitting there with his mouth open, and you were supposed to throw food into his mouth. Now, he was so lazy that if it missed a little bit, he wouldn't even lean over to get it. He wasn't hungry, was he? He was wanting to be fed, but he wasn't hungry. The time comes for you to be fed from God's truth. Are you like that old bear? You say, "Yes, I hunger and I thirst for righteousness." And we sit back and expect the preacher to throw it right into our mouth and not even cause us to have to work hard enough to lean to one side to get it. "Preacher, you better hold my attention. You better make it interesting. You better be dynamic and eloquent and make this something that I will want to listen to. And if not, maybe I'm not hungry enough to need anything right now." Let me tell you, If we're hungering and thirsting, if we are seeking God fervently, it won't matter whether the preacher is preaching in an interesting style or not. If what's being said comes from God's Word, we'll gobble it up because we are starved for God's Word. And we will have that hunger satisfied or die. We don't know anything about hunger in this life, do we? I mean, in this country. Most any of us know about hunger is maybe being a couple of hours past mealtime. I fasted one time 3 days just to see if I could find out what a little bit of hunger was. And I'm telling you, I discovered that I didn't know the meaning of the word hunger prior to that. After about the first 12 hours, I was in serious trouble. And by the time that 3 day period went by, all I could think about was food. No other thought would enter my mind except, you have got to have some food. How casual we sometimes say, I'm hungry for God's Word. And all we want is a little snack if somebody can hand it to us conveniently. Now, that's not fervently seeking. Jesus said, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be filled. Remember the passage in Deuteronomy 4:29 that we looked at in another one of the lessons, where the Lord said, when He would send them into captivity, He said, from there you will seek the Lord your God, and you will find Him if you seek Him with all your heart and with all of your soul. All of your heart and all of your soul. Or the psalmist in Psalm 42, verses 1 and 2. We sang the song tonight based upon that. As the deer pants for the water brooks, so pants my soul for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? So there needs to be some fervency in our seeking of the Lord. But equally importantly, we're going to have to serve the Lord faithfully. I think I know some people. In fact, my writing has brought me into contact with a lot of different kinds of religious folks. I'm telling you, there are weeks that go by that I have to engage in conversation with people that I never would have come in contact any other way. And a lot of them are people who would say that they are seeking God fervently. But they don't think it matters one bit how you seek God. That can just be any way you want it to be. And in fact, God can be anything you want Him to be. Well, I'm old-fashioned enough to believe that yes, we need to seek God fervently and hunger and thirst for righteousness, but God has a will about how He will be approached. And we will not find God, even though we seek Him fervently, if our seeking of Him is not faithful in its manner. We don't take the right path to God, we're not going to reach Him. All paths don't lead to the same destination. And so we must seek God faithfully. And really, by that I mean two different things. You can think of faithfulness in two different senses, can't you? Obviously, when Jesus said in John 4, verse 24, that God is seeking those who would worship Him in spirit and in truth, part of what He meant by that is that God must be worshipped in ways that are faithful to His will, ways that are accurate, ways that are truthful and right. And it's obvious that if we're going to seek God, we're going to have to seek Him based upon truth. God, we can't just make God out to be whatever we want Him to be, and we can't follow just whatever path seems to us pleasant to reach God. We'll have to worship Him in spirit and in truth. And so that's one meaning of faithfulness. Mo and I were down at Plymouth this afternoon and went aboard Mayflower 2. And I was interested to know how closely that replica of the original Mayflower might have resembled the original ship. And I asked several of them about that, and they said, well, you know, we really don't know exactly what the original Mayflower may have been like, but this is a pretty faithful replica. How were they using the word faithful? They were meaning that we believe this is a copy that is true to the original. We didn't just make up this design and say this is Mayflower too, that we tried to be faithful to the original thing. So we're going to seek God faithfully. We're going to have to seek Him in ways that are a faithful replica of the way that He would will to be sought. But there's another meaning of faithfulness, isn't there? What do we mean when we say that a husband has been faithful to his wife? And that he conducts himself faithfully to his wife? Or to put it another way, what would we mean if we said that a marital partner was guilty of infidelity? It's just a variant of the word faithful. To be an infidel means to be unfaithful. What is infidelity or unfaithfulness to a relationship? Well, it means that a person has betrayed that relationship. A person has not been true to the commitment that was involved in that relationship. And God certainly teaches, doesn't He? That if we're going to find Him, we are going to have to be faithful to Him in our seeking. James chapter 4 and verse 4, James said, adulterers and adulteresses, I don't think here he's talking about physical adultery, I think he's talking about spiritual adultery, do you not know that friendship with the world is enmity with God? God wills that we should be true to Him, faithful to His will, and faithful to Him personally in our relationship to Him. In James chapter 4 and verse 8, look at what James says. James 4 and 8, he says, draw near to God. Now that's what we're talking about, isn't it? Seeking God. So he says, draw near to God and He will draw near to you. On what condition? Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. You know why some people, many people don't find God even though they would say they're seeking Him? It's because they're not sure that's what they want to do or not. Sometimes they say, I'm seeking God. Other times they're not quite so sure. And so James talks about the double-minded man. That didn't mean somebody's twice as smart as anybody else. It means a person who's not sure. One minute he's sure, another minute he's not sure, so he's back and forth. What is the instruction that James gives to the double-minded man? Purify your hearts. Well, what passage does that remind you of? Matthew 5, verse 8, where Jesus said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Let me suggest something to you right here. You're not going to see God, I don't care if you tell me that you're seeking Him, if you don't seek Him with a pure heart. And that doesn't just mean a clean heart. James says, purify your hearts, you double-minded. The opposite of the pure heart is not the impure heart, it's the double heart. It's the heart that's not sure whether it wants to seek God or not. The only people who are going to find God are people who seek Him single-mindedly, who decide that that's what they are going to do, and there's not going to be any doubt about it. Not any surprise to me that God set it up that way. Is it to you? God wants to find out who cares and who doesn't. And He's not going to be found by some person who just goes about that casually and they're not even sure that that's what they want to do. No? Did God say to Israel, from there you will seek Me and find Me if you seek Me with all of your heart and with all of your soul. So how pure-hearted are you in your seeking of the Lord? How pure-hearted am I? Could you grow in how fervently you are seeking, and could you grow in how faithfully you are seeking Him? Do you begin to see why I said to you in the first lesson of this series that while this idea of seeking God is almost a fad in our day, very few people who talk about that in that kind of a fashionable language of being a seeker are doing anything remotely resembling seeking God. They're simply engaging in some activity that is gratifying to them in some kind of a way. And they call that seeking God. You know? God will have to be sought fervently and faithfully. And may I just say to you, there are not many people who are willing to seek God that way. A lot of people would say they are. But when it comes right down to it, you need not expect that most of the people in Boston, Massachusetts are going to seek God fervently and faithfully. But you're looking, aren't you, for those who will seek God that way. And your task in this community is the same as our task back in Indianapolis, Indiana. And that is, regardless of how many won't do that, we're looking for them who are looking for Him. We're looking for those few honest souls who really will seek God faithfully and fervently. If you'll do that, and if I'll do that, it will make a tremendous difference for good in the way we live our lives. I believe three things will come, at least three things. You might could add to this list. Three very good things come from diligently seeking God. And one of them is what I will just call greater impact. You may not think of yourself as a person who has a great deal of impact on the world in which you live. But let me tell you, the Lord's people, if they live fervently and faithfully, will have a great impact upon the world. But we won't have the kind of impact the Lord wants us to have if we don't seek Him diligently. I know you do what I do from time to time, and that is you wonder why we sometimes seemingly don't have any more impact than we do. Do you ever wonder that? Is there somebody that you are concerned about in regard to spiritual things and you would like to have some influence upon them and you may in some way or another try to influence them for good, but it just doesn't seem like your influence is very influential? And as a congregation, what do? You try to get the word out far and wide. You try to sow as much seed as possible. But what does it seem like sometimes? That's not having any impact on this community. Nobody's listening. Well, there's a lot of that that's outside of our control. As I said a minute ago, bottom line is that no matter what we do, there, in the end, there are not going to be just very many people who will be willing to seek the Lord. But I believe this also is true. That is, we will have a greater impact for good when we start seeking God diligently ourselves. And I don't know of a more sobering passage of Scripture in the Bible than Ezekiel chapter 36 and verse 23. Ezekiel 36 and verse 23. The Lord here is talking to the people of Israel in Ezekiel's day who had fallen down on the job of honoring God in the eyes of the Gentile nations. Here they're supposed to be God's special people, showing the rest of the world what it means to honor God, but they had fallen down on that job and they had dishonored God in the eyes of the Gentile nations. Listen to what was said in Ezekiel 36 and verse 23. God speaking here, He says, I will sanctify My great name, which has been profaned among the nations, which you have profaned in their midst, and the nations shall know that I am the Lord. Listen to it. The nations, that is, all those folks out there, shall know that I am the Lord when I am hallowed in you before their eyes. God is saying to Israel, in effect, the nations, those pagan nations out there, will start taking Me seriously when they see you, My people, taking Me seriously. And may I just say to you quite bluntly that the Gentiles can tell whether we are really taking God seriously or not. They can tell whether it's just words or whether it's real. If you're trying to teach your next door neighbor that God is the most important thing in the world, that that's the thing to be the most serious about, that that question means more than all the other questions put together. But knowing you as they do, they can tell that that's not really what you do, when you have to make real world decisions, then you can forget your tracts and your correspondence courses and your film strips and your television programs and your sermons and your gospel meetings. Evangelism is meaningless if we are not ourselves diligently seeking God. I don't know of a more personal application of that than to talk to us as parents. Parents, you want your kids to diligently seek God? Then you better be doing that yourself. And they can tell whether you are or whether you aren't. Let me tell you, you may not be honest enough with yourself to admit what you're really made out of, but your kids know. They know exactly what makes you tick. They know what's important to you and what you just say is important because they see how you spend your time. And that's how people tell what's really important to us. They won't tell what's really important to you when you're sitting at their table with an open Bible studying the Bible. They're going to tell what's really important to you when they see how you spend your time Monday through Saturday. And if what they see is a person who really is not very diligently seeking God, why in the world should you want them to do that if that's not something you're really doing? So if you want to have some impact, start seeking God diligently, and you'll be amazed at the impact. I'll tell you for sure, there's not anything in these lessons that we've been doing this week that I wouldn't have believed and taught 15 years ago. But I believe I take God a lot more seriously than I did 15 years ago. And I expect you may feel a little bit more impact from these lessons than you would have if I had said the very same words to you 15 years ago. Because I'm seeking God more diligently. That's where impact comes from. You can't, what did Abraham Lincoln say? I guess it was Abe Lincoln said, you know, you can't, you fool some of the people some of the time, but you can't fool all the people all the time. You can say God is your number one concern and that you're seeking Him diligently, but if people are around you long enough, they'll find out whether that's true or not. And so what God say to Israel? The nations will treat me as holy in their eyes when they see you, my special people, treating me as holy. And deeper peace and deeper joy come from taking God seriously and dealing in an appropriate way with the number one question in life. I don't know if I told you or not about that radio show producer that I was talking to a number of years ago. She had contacted me about the possibility of being on her radio program in regard to Diligently Seeking God, the book that I had written at that time. And like most radio show producers, she's wanting to know, Mr. Henry, what benefit does your book offer? You know, what benefit would your book offer to my readers? And of course, the kind of host, you know, the kind of guest that talk show producers want to have on their show is somebody who can offer their listeners the benefit of showing them how they can make more money or have more self-esteem or fix this particular problem or that particular problem in their lives. I didn't offer any of that. And I said, man, the only benefit anybody would get out of reading Diligently Seeking God is that if they read that and they did anything about it, they'd be able to put their head on their pillow at night with a clean conscience knowing that they've dealt responsibly with the number one issue in life. She said, well, I don't think the American people are too concerned about that. So she didn't book me on her radio show. But listen to me. You want some peace? You want to sleep well at night? Then take care of the number one business in life. And I may not know what you need to do about that. I may not know where you are on the spectrum of how close or how far away from God you are. I may not even know if you've cross the threshold from not being a Christian to being a Christian. You may not even obey the first principles of the gospel. Or having done that, you may be pretty far down the road. I don't know where you are, but I know that whoever you are, you're just like I am, and there's some step that would, for you, be the next step you need to take. Seeking God diligently always means having whatever it is that it takes to take the next step. And if you will do that, you'll sleep better tonight than you've slept in a long time. And if you won't do that, I hope you don't sleep tonight. So is there any benefit from taking God seriously at our level? Well, is peace of mind any benefit? It is to me, you know, whether it is to some talk show radio audience or not, that's a big benefit as far as I'm concerned, and that's what I'm about in life. That's what I'm trying to help people do, is deal rightly with the number one issue in life. Take God more seriously. And there obviously is great joy that comes from that. You just couldn't describe, could you? The joy, the real joy, which is a big different thing than mere happiness, but the joy that comes from seeking God diligently. And I'll tell you, a part of the joy of really being a Christian, a part of the joy of diligently seeking God, lies in the fact that it's a tremendous adventure. You really don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. If you embark upon diligently seeking God, then you put yourself in the same kind of position that Abraham did when he said, okay, I'll leave Ur of the Chaldees and just tell me where you want me to go. And I'll guarantee you the rest of his life was an adventure. He didn't know what was going to happen before the end, except that God would take care of the details. You want some excitement? You want some joy and some adventure in your life? Then take God seriously. And there'll be a joy that will come from that that will far surpass the joy that comes from dealing with the trinkets and the baubles of the things that people think make them happy in this world. So there's good stuff that comes from diligently seeking God. But finally, let me quickly say that doing that, taking the next step, making spiritual progress, is the result of discipline. And I don't know how to say it any differently than to use the word discipline. That's not a bad word. It's one of the best words and one of the best ideas in any language. To be under discipline means to be under training. Have you ever thought about the word training? What is training? To train means to teach to follow. What is a railroad train? It's a situation where there's a locomotive and certain cars follow wherever that locomotive goes. What is the train on a bridal gown? It's something that follows that bride wherever she goes. That's why it's called a train. It follows her. To train yourself means to teach your flesh to follow God's Spirit. To take instructions. To follow. Not to lead, but to follow. And your flesh doesn't want to follow. Your flesh is like an untrained, like Wrigley, my wonderful Australian Shepherd that I had when I first got it. Great animal. Champion bloodline. But boy, he was untrained, meaning he would not follow my instructions. And he had to be taught that when master says, do this, that it was his responsibility to do that. And he finally got to the one where he was trained. It would be under my command. But it didn't come naturally for him. And your flesh is going to have to be trained if you're going to make any spiritual progress. Because it doesn't want to follow the dictates of your spirit. It wants to do what it wants to do. And in the case of most of us, flesh is used to getting its way most of the time, right? I love Krispy Kreme donuts. Do you have Krispy Kreme donuts in this neck of the woods? Second best day of my life. First best day of my life is when I obeyed the gospel, but second best day of my life is when Krispy Kreme started taking MasterCard. And when my flesh says, I want a Krispy Kreme donut, my spirit can very often say, no, you don't need another Krispy Kreme donut. But flesh usually wins out. Flesh usually gets its way because it's not trained like it ought to be to take orders, to follow rather than lead. When Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane came and found his disciples asleep, they were going to try to stay awake with him and pray with him, and they fell asleep. What did the Lord say? The spirit is willing, but the flesh is weak. Flesh is untrained. Their spirit had said, flesh, stay awake. The flesh did what it wanted to do and went to sleep. It was undisciplined. It was untrained. And the only way you're going to get a disciplined body that will carry out the dictates of your spirit and help you get to heaven rather than hinder you is to be trained. And that's going to come at the cost of some pain, unfortunately. While flesh is taught to take orders from spirit, we'll do that. If we'll work on disciplining ourselves, then we will make progress. Paul said to Timothy in 1 Timothy 4 and verse 15. Think about these things. Meditate on them, he said. Give yourself entirely to them that your progress may be evident to all. Paul said in 1 Corinthians 9 verse 27, I discipline my body. I train my body and bring it into subjection, lest when I have preached to others, I myself should become disqualified. So bring some discipline to bear. There's not any good thing in the world that doesn't come from discipline. I don't care how much talent you have, how much ability you have, how much potential you have in the Lord's work, if you will not discipline that and cause your body and your flesh to take orders from your spirit, then all of that's going to go for naught. So let's make some progress by disciplining ourselves. And then faithful stewardship is the result of diligence. There's just no shortcut. 2 Timothy 2 and verse 15, very familiar passage. What did Paul say? Be diligent. The older version said study, but in 1611, to study meant to work hard at something, to make a studied effort to do it. So give diligence to present yourself approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. We're going to have to do some accounting. All of us have been endowed with tremendous abilities. And that's true no matter who you are. A human being is an amazing thing. To be created in God's image means to have been given free will and ability to choose and to obey and to do things that reflect honor unto God. But what kind of stewardship are we exercising over those considerable gifts? One day we're going to have to answer for it. One day we're going to have to stand for an interview before the Master, who will say, I gave you these tools. What did you do with them? Paul says we need to be working hard, giving diligence, so that as workmen whose work is going to be inspected, we won't be embarrassed about the quality of our work when the time comes. If we're not going to be embarrassed about it, now's the time to be working hard. It'll be too late then to offer anything except shoddy workmanship to the Master, which will be a shame to us. God is dishonored. We insult Him if we approach Him with anything less than diligence. And so it comes down to a matter of diligence, doesn't it? There's a sense in which anything less than diligent seeking of God is really not seeking Him at all. You just as soon be an enemy of the Lord as to seek Him with anything less than diligence. If He deserves anything at all, He deserves our very best. The highest that we can give Him, for He in fact did give us His highest, as we said in our good prayer before the lesson this evening. He is God. We are His creatures. He has given His Son to die that we might once again be His spiritual children. And He deserves nothing less than purity of heart and hungering and thirsting for righteousness. And I challenge you to find some way that you can be more diligent about it. And not just to leave it in the realm of theory and, well, that sounds like a good idea kind of thinking. So look for some area in your life where you can really do things differently, if it's even just a little bit. But take God more serious. And I promise you that I'll do the same thing. I'll guarantee you that these lessons originated in an effort for Gary Henry to redig the wells of his own faith a few years ago when the roof caved in and the world came apart for him. This old fella had to go back and reconsider everything, find out if my faith was worth having or not. And so I'm preaching to myself. If you're getting any good out of it, then that'll just be icing on the cake. But I'm telling you, we need to seek God diligently. Now, before we extend the invitation, let me say to you that tomorrow night, we're going to talk about some very important things in regard to why we ought to do that. And you haven't studied the Bible very much if you haven't figured out that God's concerned not only about the what, but about the why. We do the what. And I believe it makes or breaks our seeking of God depending upon why we do that and what it is that we're trying to get out of it. And I will try to speak as carefully as I can tomorrow night, but I'm going to have to say some things tomorrow night that may make you a little uncomfortable because they make me uncomfortable. I'm going to try to reformat your hard drive tomorrow night. This lesson will be the spiritual equivalent of the F-disk command back in the DOS days. I want to adjust you a little bit. I want to scratch your hard drive clean and start over with a fresh way of thinking about what this whole thing is all about. So we hope that you can be with us tomorrow night for the concluding lesson. But if you're here tonight and you are subject to the Lord's invitation, our desire as people who are trying to serve the Lord as faithfully as we know how to do that we would want you to know that you're in an audience of people who are concerned about you and who will help you in any way that we can. We can assist you in obeying the Lord in any way. The step that you need to take is a step that requires somebody else's assistance. And that very well may be. Then we're here for you. Won't you come as we stand and sing the invitation song?